Welcome to Q&A, a queer and alternative podcast brought to you by GCN, Ireland's national LGBT press. All year, we've been marking 30 years in publishing, and we cap this anniversary year by marking another milestone, 30 years of World AIDS Day. We're very proud to present to you this conversation between the Queen of Ireland, Panty, and Professor Mulcahy, recorded live at Smock Alley Theatre.
Hi. Hi. Oh, calm down, calm down. That's very lovely of you and all, but unnecessary. Now, I have my phone here, not because I'm going to be on Grindr or anything. It's on airplane mode. Make sure you do the same. It's for my little few notes and keep the time. Hi, I'm Panty, and I feel like I'm on trial whenever I'm in here. It's weird. And we are, it was described as a performance I just heard. I don't think of it as a performance. I think we're having a chat, right? And before we get to the chat, I just want to briefly introduce you to Mary Shannon. Where is Mary? Mary, come up to me for a second. We want to talk about the quilt here. Hi. I have my reading glasses on, so you look great. Mary is the custodian of the quilt. Well, the Irish...
Names.
Yes, the Irish names quilt. Do you have all of the Irish pieces?
All the Irish.
And how many are there?
There's some others now. Rialto have their own one, and I think there's another one as well. But this is the...
Yeah. Use that microphone, Mary, because I just wanted to briefly you to explain to everybody how you got involved there. Is that on? There you go. How did you get involved, Mary?
A very good friend of mine was in England and presented with HIV. Mm-hmm. And when we got him home, he actually educated me on HIV.
Yeah.
And before he died, we'd done everything together. And when he died, then another person came home from America and showed us a book about this quilt in America. And we thought we'd have to make one for Joan. That was Joe's one there. The very first one that was ever made here in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And his name as well. His mother and father used to work with us, and his family worked in the workshop with us.
Yeah, that was in 1990, I assume.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so how did then you end up being the custodian of it?
I continued on with it. Mm. And I kept, when everybody else, you know, when people started dwindling away, I just kept going out with it. And that's how I'm still here.
And you started bringing it around quite a few places to show people. And
at that time, I could be out 4 or 5 days a week.
Wow.
We went all around Ireland, the north of Ireland and Ireland. We went to America, we went to London, Amsterdam, all over the place with it. Mm-hmm. And at the moment now, the quilt has, all over the world, has got so big it'll never be shown in its entirety again. Mm. But I just kept going with it, and then people then thought that there was no AIDS or HIV in Ireland, and they started dwindling away, and that's the way it was.
So how many pieces do you have?
We have 13.
13?
Yeah, 13 quilts, full quilts.
Okay.
And, it's lovely to see them.
Well, Mary, you're going to hang around afterwards when we're having our little wine reception, and there are two more panels upstairs where the wine reception is going to be. So, Mary loves to chat and tell everybody about it, so feel free to ask her as many questions as you want about it later. Thank you,
okay,
Mary.
Okay. And you.
I don't know. And so let's get to the meat of it. Now, we're going to talk to Professor Mulcahy for about 45 minutes, and then we're going to have a Q&A, so you can ask whatever you want in the allotted time. But I am going to finish at 8:30, and we're going to go upstairs for a wine reception. And if you have any more burning questions at that point, you can corner us over a glass of wine. So, Professor Mulcahy, please come and join us. I don't know which side you want to be. I should point out that the last time I actually saw Fiona, she was looking up my bum through a glass tube. And that is the honest to God truth, isn't it? Isn't it?
Definitely.
And I'll see you in Smock Alley in a few weeks. Well, that must happen to you all the time, right?
Yeah. The nurses said they were giving out, oh, I'm really sorry we called you in there. And I said, oh, he wouldn't mind anyway.
Yeah, no, I have absolutely no shame at all. I ran out long ago. Well, one of the things that I want to, today we're marking, 30 years of World AIDS Day. And we want to talk especially about the activism around it and all that. But of course, you're not an activist, you're a medic, and you're always very careful to sort of say that, because you come at it from an entirely different point of view. So the first thing I want to sort of talk to you about is, you know, what is a nice girl like you doing up to her oxters in, you know, gonorrhea and HIV? How did you get into all of this?
Yeah, it was serendipity. I mean, I started off doing gastroenterology. I was working in Leeds, and they sent me down on this course to St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London. Mm. And anyway, I went and stayed with an old registrar who had been in Dublin. So we sat up one night drinking a glass of wine and a bottle of wine, actually, and then more. And she said, "What on earth are you doing in that specialty? It's going nowhere. There are no jobs. Women don't get the jobs, even if you're the best. You know, my marriage is on the rocks. My kids, I had them in my holidays. So get out of it." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I've been thinking, where else?" And she said, "Oh, a good friend of mine loves hepatitis, and he's gone into hepatitis with from Sheila Sherlock's unit into the clinic in the Middlesex in London, because they're all these gay men have hepatitis." And I said, "Oh my God, that might be interesting." So anyway, I went back the next day, and there on the notice board in the Leeds General Infirmary was looking for a locum position in GU medicine. And I said, "Oh, I'll try it." And I thought, at that time, I loved, you know, really sick patients. I liked living on the edge. You know, the sicker they were, the better. But and then I was going into STDs. You know, very sort of, and they said, you know, no sick patients at all. And then it was within that 6 month period, HIV sort of hit the whole Leeds scene, and there were really sick people.
What year was that?
That was in, I was there between 1984 to 1987, okay. Yeah. So, and the people I was working with, we were looking after all the patients, but they had sort of almost become like dermatologists, not really involved in acute medicine. So I sort of took on all of those. So that was, and then I thought, oh, my lucky days. Here are there, everybody is so sick. It was...
but you know, like, so it was 1984, and your family background, you know, they're, you know, nice middle class family, are they?
My father was a civil servant. We weren't that well off.
Well, I don't mean that. I just mean, like, you know, you go home to your mother and you say, "Well, actually, you know, I'm working with the gays and the drug addicts, and it's all hepatitis and gonorrhea."
They were okay with that. My poor grandmother, though. My grandmother used to, every time I was on a rotation in as a junior doctor in Dublin, she'd pitch up and they'd ring me from the switchboard. "Oh, guess who's here? Oh, it's your grandmother from Kerry." And I'd go down. And then, so, you know, and then I remember being in rheumatology, and one day I'd go down to the outpatient clinic. Nothing wrong with her now. And she would arrive there, and my there was my grandmother waiting to see the consultant, and I was thinking, "Oh my God, what is she doing?" You know. Anyway, I was saved. The day I went into STI, she never pitched up, never turned up.
But so, I mean, you paint that as if it was like, this is all accidental, and the next thing you know, you're there. Mm. But what makes HIV different than all the other, you know, things you could have gone into is the kind of the groups that it affects.
Yeah.
So you are suddenly, you know, on first name terms with at the time, every hemophiliac, every gay, and every addict. So it is a very specific thing, and not like any of the other things which are sort of, you know, affect everybody. And was that something that was immediately obvious from day one to you, or is that something that appeared, sort of?
I suppose it sort of more appeared rather than, did I make a conscious decision, oh, I want to look after groups that are, at that stage, were so marginalized. Mm. Not really. I didn't see people as marginalized. I don't think I ever do, but it's just, it's more that they were patients and that was it.
Yeah.
They need somebody to look after them. I was as good as anybody else.
And, well, that's also something that's always struck me about people who work in the clinics is that, you know, obviously, in any job like that, you have to be unjudgmental because you're just doing your job, whatever. But in that one, so I was diagnosed in 95. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I would go to the clinic, and there were very separate, the three groups, in a way. But they're also very obvious. I used to laugh and joke with people that you'd go in and there'd be all the addicts, you know, sort of causing, you know, hassle in a way. And the gays would be fighting over the only copy of Heat magazine. And the hemophiliacs would be sitting in the corner thinking, what are we doing here? We did nothing wrong. You know? But there was a real truth to that in the sense that the hemophiliacs were always presented as the innocent victims.
I know.
And so every radio program, or whatever, you know, the TV, it was always, these are the, you know, the good people who, you know, terrible. And the gays and the addicts were sort of
mixed.
Yeah, and they were absolutely treated differently.
Yeah.
But not in the clinic.
Not in the clinic, no. And, well, I suppose the haemophiliacs did get their own clinic. So they it certainly moved out, and because they were a very set cohort, yeah. and it wasn't an enlarging cohort,
yeah.
whereas we had this cohort that was growing all the time. And we did think, you know, that one of the questions was, would we have selected, you know, a clinic for drug users and a clinic for gay men and keep that separate? And we decided not to do that. I think probably... that was a good decision, yeah. really, in ways, but it certainly kept it entertaining.
Well, if you were a gay drug addict? I mean, that'd be a big decision.
Yeah. You'd have to choose. Yeah.
And then the other thing is, you fell out accidentally, and as you say, you, and I suspect a lot of doctors, they do want to be working in something that's exciting and life and death stuff. That's why you become a doctor, right? And you couldn't have chosen better, in a way.
No.
And the arc of HIV... has been incredibly interesting in a way that most aren't.
Nobody would have anticipated. I mean, if you were to say, you know, I suppose for all of us who have worked in this area, like, it has been the most amazing journey, considering where we started and so many people dying and the level of, you know, sort of suffering and sickness and death and palliative care and all of that, to go from that to where we are today. I mean, it's been... unbelievable.
Yeah.
Nobody would have anticipated that. Mm. And I suppose it was a real privilege to do that. Yeah.
Well, but a privilege and also like a responsibility, because when I am talking to younger people about it, I'm always trying to explain to them what that was like at the time. And, you know, so my memory always of it is, you know, that I was diagnosed by my GP and then he sent me to James's. Mm-hmm. And on my first visit to James's, you saw me, actually, and you get me the spiel,
yeah.
and you tried to not make it totally black at the time, and then I was sent to the social worker, who was there to see every new patient, and the social worker basically told me, right, we're going to make dying as easy as possible. You know,
she was telling
me I could get a blanket allowance, and you know, how about getting the door, because I wouldn't be able to work, of course, and you know, all this stuff, and I was sitting there, sort of feeling like, you know, when you see in a movie and they have the lineup, you know, and somebody has to go and say it's that guy, and I felt like I was, you know, had been picked out of a lineup, but you know, it was a mistake.
I know, and we were very honest, you know, that was almost maybe too honest, but we certainly, like, if somebody asked you, well, you know, how long more do you think I have, you know, then we would say, okay, if you want to do this, now is the time to do it or whatever. I always
you
remember.
You gave me 5 years.
Oh, did I?
Yeah. But I can't swear that you were the one who actually said 5 years, but that's what was the impression I was given.
I'll tell you a story about this. One of my patients, also came in and said, you know, how long do you think I have to live? And I said, like, he was really sick. He had CMV and PCP and everything. I said, I think, you know, you'd be lucky with 18 months, okay? He said, oh, fine, okay, that's good to know. I'll let you know. I'm going to think about that. So he came back the next thing and he said, you know, I've decided I'm going to do something. And he said, I'm going to book my own funeral. I said, really? He said, yeah, I don't want my family to have to pay for it. I'm going to go pay for it. And I said, okay. And so he comes back the next week and I said, how'd you get on? He said, well, he said, I was really lucky. Massey's have this fantastic special deal, £400. So he said, I went in and to book the funeral. So he said, I went in to book the funeral and I booked. I said, oh God, what'd you get for 400? Well, he said, I got the hearse. He said, I got the coffin and I got the whole shebang, the grave and everything. And I said, oh, and he said, but you know, it was a terrible experience. I said, oh God. He said, I went in there and I said, I want to book. And they said, oh, very sorry for your trouble. Who's dead belonging to you? And he said, well, there was nobody dead, but I was booking it for myself. And they said, oh dear, that would put them off. He said, I want to know exactly what I get. And they told him all of this. And they said, okay, well, what's the coffin like? And he said, well, it's basic, you know, the basic coffin, but there it is over there. And what do you wear in it? And he said, oh, I forgot to tell you, you're, you know, a shroud. You can have a shroud and you can have either pink, blue or white. And he said, oh, right. And he said, okay, I want to try on that one, get in there, and I want to try on that one. Anyway, and they called the guards, honestly. And they said, But actually, he was a lawyer, so he said, no, according to this, I'm entitled. So he did the works, and then he picked out whichever he said. So he came in, and that was when you were diagnosed, 1995, when the big development in antiretroviral therapy was, and we knew that patients were going to live much longer and potentially survive, and it was a real, you know, watershed in terms of HIV. So he anyway did very well, and in fact became completely well, started writing books. And he said the most embarrassing day was the day he went in to get his money back. So anyway,
that's anyway,
very funny. But
that, you know, that is a real fun story. But it's very illustrative too, because there was all that thing where everyone thought you were going to die.
Yeah.
They were preparing you for that eventuality. The visits to the clinic were reinforcing that. I used to hit, you know, there was always lots of really sick people in the clinic, and sometimes you'd see people regularly, and then you just wouldn't see them again. And the staff always had this sort of great, you know, I guess a coping gallows humor. And what you needed at the time. Yeah. And then along came the changes. And then suddenly, people like me and all the other people I would see, you know, who had never considered a fucking pension, who had, you know, I had stopped paying my taxes at one point because I thought, what is the point, you know? And so all that happens, and then you suddenly have to readjust everything. And then that became a pain in the ass.
But we had to rethink everything, And then suddenly you are looking at making sure everybody gets diagnosed as soon as possible, get on treatment as soon as possible to avoid the disaster without treatment. You know, when somebody presents late, then that's when we see people who don't do well, obviously. So there, and we still have patients like that. That's the tragedy, really.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I personalize this a little. A friend, good friend of ours, it's only a few years ago, and he knew, for example, me and other friends of ours who were living with HIV and doing very well and all that. And he was diagnosed, was so freaked out by it, he put his head in the sand, he didn't tell anybody, he told nobody and never went back to the clinic, and then got very sick and he died, and it devastated the clinic in James's because it was so unnecessary.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I always say when we talk about that stigma killed him.
Yeah.
HIV didn't kill him in a way. Yeah. That's my interpretation of that.
And I suppose stigma has been, it's been cornerstone really, and that has sort of pushed along, has been good in one way because it has made people talk about things that they would never have talked about before. I mean, HIV sort of allowed the development of an open sexual health discussion in Ireland, which had never been the case. Yep. You know, when I came back first, there was no condoms. At my interview for the job, when I went to a consultant post in James's, they asked me, did I think that homosexuality should be legalized? How could I possibly examine men? I mean, could you imagine in a sort of a senior consultant position that was? So I think it changed the whole sexual health message, which was, you know, amazing at the time. But I think I'm hopeful that stigma is much less than it was. I think people talk about it. I think the, having PrEP and all of that has been very good as well.
Well, it is definitely less than it was. I mean, there was, there was the time when people literally wouldn't touch you or wouldn't drink from your glass and all of that. But it's still there. And you only have to pick up a bloody, a dating app to see it or whatever. But do you think, though, that you being a woman helpful or a hindrance?
I probably became a mammy to some of the men.
But,
I didn't think it was a hindrance. I think it's difficult for women in medicine and probably... still difficult, but it was certainly when I was there at that time. So you minimise the amount of time you took off and so forth. So if you were good, you had to be as good as all your male colleagues and probably better. I don't think that is the case anymore. But in terms of dealing with patients, I think probably the men had more of a problem sometimes, they...
Well, I mean, this is just mine, but I find it easy. Would have found it easy to talk about that sort of stuff with a woman than with a straight man. And that's my own issue. Because people like Colm and Bergen and that are totally great and non-judgmental. But I find that, talk about that sort of intimate stuff, I think it's easier for most gay men to talk to a woman about it.
We love talking to gay men because they always tell you you look great and you've got a new hairstyle and, you know, yeah.
Well, actually, speaking of that, because I only just realised yesterday talking to you on the phone there what age you are. And you, do you mind if I say it? Because,
no problem.
Because, you know, they can just Google it anyway. She's 62. Like, yeah, look, that is good. Which I guess I should have known theoretically just by thinking about it. But yeah, you look good for 62.
Thank you.
The aspect about HIV and the activism is really other conditions. And sorry, I always call it a disease. And I know that medics and so and pedants tell me it's not because it's a, you know, syndrome and all that. But I've always hated that because when it was killing me, I wanted to be able to shout about it. And you know, and syndrome is just like, you can't be annoyed at a syndrome.
I know.
Do you know what I mean? I don't like the vocabulary of it.
Yeah.
You know, I had a fucking disease. You know.
Yeah.
I always call it a disease, and you know, fuck you if you want to get out. So no other diseases, conditions, syndromes. They didn't need activism. Everybody's on board about, you know, heart attacks.
Yeah.
You know, or you know, leukemia. Everyone's fine, you know.
Oh yeah, no problem.
Exactly.
Fundraisers for that.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, people have to fundraise and all that stuff, but they don't have to defend or they don't have to be suspicious of people's motives maybe or whatever, or lack of motives or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So AIDS threw up this very specific you know, it was just a very specific condition around it that no other disease had.
Yep.
And it was the shame about it and the stigma about it and, you know, the various groups that had it and the religious stuff and, you know, all piled in there.
Yeah.
Now, you can't have anticipated that when you set out. You were, I'm a doctor. I'm going to, you know, try and cure people of illnesses. And then suddenly, you're involved in this thing which is on the front page of every paper. Mm-hmm. People are afraid of it. There's activism growing up around it. There's arguments between the medical community and activist communities. And you didn't choose that. That happened. And in a way, you couldn't sort of look to another, you know, consultant in another area and sort of say, what's that like? Because nobody else had to deal with all the stuff around it. So what was that like?
I mean, that was different and sort of having to deal with, because, you know, as doctors, you're very pragmatic. You know, you sort of see a problem, you want a definite solution, and you go through a process. Whereas that wasn't the case for HIV. So you'd had, and activism was, it wasn't, you know, like when in the UK, where I was training, and in the US, it was, you know, the rich and the famous were the activists, you know, and they were out there. Whereas in Ireland, it was more sort of gentle.
Mm.
But yet there were great people that sort of worked in the background.
Mm.
You know, there were amazing people that sort of volunteered who were patients themselves, but helped out all our drug addicts. For instance, there was a great group run Comfort Aid. I'm sure you remember all of them. And they did huge amount of work. And like it was selfless without looking for heroic recognition. That was never in Ireland. You know, people never were sort of held up, oh, look at that wonderful activist, or look at, he was famous, he did all that. Like there were the forgotten group that sort of quietly did a lot of really great work, you know, and we depended on them. Like we'd ring up somebody, like, you know, I remember I had a patient who was lived in the flats, who was really poor, and his mother had, and he became blind with PML, and he needed to come to the clinic, but nobody. So, you know, we rang two of the guys that we knew and said, any chance you could pick him up, you know, and bring him to the clinic? And they said, oh, no problem. So for every week, they used to go and collect him down the flats, bring him in. Until one day they said, God, we're invited to his birthday party. What'll we do? And I said, oh, God, you can't not go. You know, you're going into those flats. Your car isn't annihilated. Everybody knows you pick them up. You better go to that party. So off they went to the party and we were saying, how did you get on? And it was Jerry McNamara. Remember
Jerry? Oh, yes.
And they were saying, God, it was unbelievable. There we were, sticky buns and everything. And the mom was sat down. She said, you know, life is really hard. She said, there's poor,
and he's blind, and, you know, his brother is in Mountjoy, and the other guy's had his leg shot off. And she said, but worse still, the tiles are falling off the bathroom, you know. so life was, but it was, you know, like, and I know Trish in, you know, in Conway there, who worked in Cherry Orchard, like, there were huge groups that helped out kitting out the old hospitals, like the place, like, we were working at, it was falling down, and yet it was a lot of people. And then we had some groups that were running sort of wonderful barbecues and everything, and they came to us and said, oh, we want to do something specifically for the patients, so how about, you know, Ralph Lauren dressing gowns with smoked salmon. And I was like, but that didn't work.
Yeah. Well, so I've always had this, like, be my bonnet about James's.
Yeah.
The Guy Clinic is at the very back of the hospital. It's hard to find.
Yeah.
It's in a shitty building, no offense.
Yeah.
You've done your best to paint and all that along the over the years. And it's better than it was. And slowly over the years, I'm going there, I see all the rest of the hospitals becoming gleaming and modern and glass things being built. And then recently, of course, they had the sort of geriatric building like that, literally built around the little shitty, you know, thing, stealing even our sunlight, you know, like, even they even get the sun from us. I just like, am I... Well, the impression I have always had is, like, they just want to keep it back there. It's the, you know, the addicts and the gays, and let's just have them back there and hidden away, and they can have the shitty building. And I might be totally unfair.
We think that too.
Oh, good.
It is. And you know, it's, well, if you ask, why did, like, Chuck Feeney paid for that Mesa building, you know? So it was the grannies on the trolleys. Okay, so it was the media, it was everybody talking about this was, you know, unfair.
Yeah.
Whereas nobody actually says anything. They, you know, our patients say, oh, you're so nice, thanks very much for looking after us. And nobody gives out, really, that often. And maybe what we need is somebody to say, it's, you know, it's unacceptable. Why is there this difference? So we have, and, you know, it's, so if you rely on us as the medics to do that, we don't have enough energy left over to do that. And so if there isn't a huge group that do it, then we sort of, we languish in where we are, to be honest.
I mean, because in a way, it's still, to this day, it is the awkward one to talk about. And people want you to have, you know, a sad story that makes you innocent in the story.
Yeah.
Because this day still, they treat it differently because there's the idea that you brought on yourself somehow, whatever. Which drives me mad. Like, if I ever mention, you know, the medication on Twitter or something, there'll be some asshole who'll say, oh, and we're paying for that and our taxes. And I always say to them, like, do you see a person in a wheelchair and go up and demand to know how they ended up in a wheelchair? Did they cross the road, you know, one day without looking very well? And then if they say yes, do you rip the wheelchair off them and say, my taxes pay for that and you don't deserve it? You know, it's specific because it's around, you know, sex and sexuality. And I don't want to, you know, pull Ireland out because lots of places are the same. But we, of course, do have a great long tradition of, you know, shaming people for their sexual behavior.
Yeah.
And this is another, it's another one.
Yeah.
So... like, you're a doctor, and I know that in the field and in the hospital, that all those judgments are out. You are just doing your job and helping to get people better. But outside of hospital, did you feel that, especially early, and has that changed?
Did I feel?
I feel it as a patient.
Yeah.
But did you feel it as somebody who's just working with these groups? Did you feel you had to defend sometimes
what I was doing?
Yeah, sort of.
No, maybe not. You know, maybe, you see, I probably saw it from Rose. You know, it was, I'd say a lot of people, if they were honest and were in other areas of medicine, would have thought, oh, I'd love to work in that area. It's so interesting. Patients are interesting. It's, the disease is interesting. They wouldn't, certainly not dealing with the gay community.
Yeah.
But perhaps then the other issue would be, yes, dealing with the drug users, I'd say, was a big problem initially. You know, that they, patients was, and lots of hospitals certainly didn't want them. Like, there are, there was, you know, a lot, I won't say. But anyway, a lot of, I'd be good.
Vincent's. Bound to be Vincent's. I'm just guessing, so I don't know that. So you had to sort of...
So that, you know, like, that was exhausting, really. Sometimes, you know, you'd be dealing with people to come in with knives, come in threatening, you know, beat you up, you know, things like that would happen. Yeah. And so that was, they were the challenges, yeah.
And the other thing that I'm always very conscious of is that, you know, sometimes when you read something or about treatments or whatever, and I think people outside of it, they sometimes just... Yes. Oh, that's great, whatever. But I'm always that there are, because there are these different communities affected. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I think, well, okay, that's great, but I don't think that an awful lot of the addicts are their lives are stable enough to stick to that regime or whatever. So you have to think about different things from more perspectives than just one, if you know what I mean.
I mean, and that has obviously, if anybody's looked at the recent statistics, like the instance of new drug users becoming HIV positive is minute. So they are a group that, you know, used to represent a huge percentage of our patients, and they've gone down to 15% or so. So in fact, they are no longer constitute a huge problem, whereas they were the major group that we were looking after beforehand. Yeah.
Yep.
But would you change it? I'm telling you, the best sense of humour from patients are the inner city Dublin drug users. They are unbelievable. Yeah. You know, you're there. I remember one day I was giving out to a patient and saying, why aren't you taking those meds? Do you know how much they cost? You're going to get sick if you don't take the meds. You know, I'm thinking, maybe if I give out long enough that they'll know. And they say, why don't you take it? And he said, Jesus, doctor, will you give me a break? My fridge committed suicide because the tablets at those stage had to be kept in the fridge. But I, you know, and life, you know, we're all, like most of us here, have, you know, are speaking from living in, you know, reasonable family homes. And if you saw, you know, the sort of how many of our patients were brought up, how they, the conditions in which they lived, the trouble, you know, it, you'd be saying, would any of us have been any different? I don't think so.
You know? Yeah.
Anyway. So, but they put...
I mean, it just has been... I'm going to check the time, because I know, where are we? Oh, we're good.
Ready for another drug, but it's a legal one.
Say that, what? Yes, upstairs. And it has been this sort of remarkable journey, and exciting from your point of view, and from my point of view, thrilling in a way, and occasionally annoying. But what I still today, that I feel in the same way that I did then, is that people want you to present it in a particular way, and they don't want you to just tell the facts. If the facts are inconvenient to how they want to view it, and so, for example, at the moment, I see that around two things. One is around PrEP, and the other is then around just me telling what the story of what it's like to be HIV positive now. So I am, you know, often asked about it, and I will say the truth, which is I take my one pill a day. Mm-hmm. I take it in the morning. I never think about it. I often think, fuck, did I take the pill yet? Because it's like, I do it on automatic pilot.
Yeah.
And then I don't think about it for days on end until I meet you or somebody else asking something about it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a constant presence in my life. And in a way, it never has been, even in the baddest days, because life drags you along, as you said earlier on. I always say to people that, you know, you told me, maybe 5 years and we're all good, you know, whatever, and here's your blanket allowance, and then the next day I ran out of bin bags. You know, so I still had to go to the bloody supermarket and get bin bags.
Yeah.
Because, you know, life just keeps going. It doesn't stop and allow you to, you know, sort of wallow. So I tell the story now, and I say, you know, it doesn't affect my life. I don't think about it. I always compare it to, you know, I have a tattoo on my back. I never see my tattoo. I can't see my tattoo. I might go 6 months and not even think about it until somebody says, oh, you've got a tattoo. You know, I don't think of myself as a tattooed person.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think of myself as somebody with HIV all the time. And I take a tablet. And even when I take a tablet, I'm not consciously thinking, this is about HIV.
Yeah.
It's just a thing.
Yeah.
And so when I tell that story, and that is the truth of it, people get upset with me sometimes because they think I'm making it sound too easy. and that they don't want me to give people the impression that they don't have to worry or care about it. Now, I always say it is life-changing. Yeah. You are taking this drugs all the time. You know, you don't want to get it, so, you know, avoid getting it. But that is the truth, and I'm not going to lie about it. What do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is totally manageable. You can live a totally normal life. I think people don't really worry too much about picking it up the way they did before. You know, and some people say, oh, well, I'm going to get it at some stage. Might as well get it now. And sure, I'll only take the one pill a day. Honestly. So the only thing is that they're tied into us. You know, you're going to have to come every 6 months. You're going to have to have bloods. You're going to have, you know, it's not as good as being negative.
Oh, my God. No, absolutely. Isn't. Yeah. It is a pain in the ass.
Yes, yeah.
The clinic visits and all that stuff.
And you're coming from a perspective where you expect it to be horrendously ill and die early.
Yeah.
And now, so for you now, it's no bother. But for, you know, somebody who is young, you know, say you're in your early 20s and you're saying, okay, you need to take this tablet every solitary day. It's no, you know, a no-brainer. Yeah. It's quite hard to do that if you're, you know, so I would say you better off avoiding HIV.
Absolutely, you are. underscore. And you're right, because it's from my perspective. Because, you know, I was taking the 38 pills a day, and the ones that made you feel nauseous, and the ones that had to be taken with fat, and the ones that had to be taken in the morning, and on an empty stomach, and, you know, it was a full-time fucking job, you know, just taking the tablets at the right way and all that. And so to me now, having this one, and like, for example, before this one that I'm particularly taking, I was taking another one. It gave me horrible, intense dreams, and my equilibrium was knocked out for a while. And, you know, I sort of had to put my hand on the wall. And I had that for 3 years before I even mentioned it to any of you, because I just thought that was brilliant.
Compared to what it was.
You know, I thought I'd reached, you know, the end. And then, you know, whatever, when the doctor was like, you don't have, we'll just change it to something else. But it was because I was so thrilled to be at that position.
Whereas now my new patients are coming in and say, oh, see this pill, I'd like you to prescribe this one. I like the sound of that one. So it's like shopping supermarket.
Yeah. So people get annoyed at me they think I'm minimizing it.
Yeah.
But there's no point in lying to people about it.
Yeah, and there's no point making it. I think if you make it a huge thing, then you perhaps add stigma to it.
Yes, because this. Oh my God, we're so on the same wavelength here, because this is what I was leading up to. Because for me in my life, the thing that still annoys me and bothers me and I have to deal with is the stigma around it. Mm-hmm. And I have been open about my diagnosis, you know, since, you know, a few months after I was diagnosed. And sometimes people, you know, think that was brave or something, but it wasn't. It was because I have a big mouth and I couldn't possibly not. You know, I'm just not the person to be able to keep something like that in. And it has become easier, you know, for sure, as time went on. But it is still a judgment on it about you. And so I made a very conscious decision to attempt to normalize it in my life, you know, long ago. And so I would do jokes about it and tell funny stories on stage about it. And sometimes people would get upset with me about it, and I'd say, well, it's my disease too, and this is how I'm doing it.
Yeah.
But I never made the jokes flippantly. They may have sounded flippant, but I had thought hard and long about it. And so I wanted to make it something we can laugh about, talk about, normalize, because I feel if you can laugh at something, the fear is taken out of it somewhat. Mm-hmm. And today we have many discussions about stigma and how to sort of erase the stigma, because stigma stops people getting tested, it stops people talking about it, it, you know, stops people going on treatment after they have been tested, all sorts of issues. And people who don't get tested are the ones who then, you know, can pass it on. So I want to get rid of it. And to me, it is a bit like just coming out as gay.
Mm-hmm.
What changed attitudes, you know, to homosexuality was gay people standing up and saying, I'm one of those people. Because it's super easy and normal to have prejudices against people that you don't know and you've never met.
Sure.
And so you'll believe anything about them.
Yeah.
And so when gay people started to say, I'm gay, whatever, it erased that stigma, because then, you know, Nora, who's hearing something on the radio, goes, oh, well, actually, that can't be true, because I know Tom next door, and I, you know Mary, who's teaching the kids, and her girlfriend, or whatever. So that's what changed people's attitudes. And my feeling is that we could end most of the stigma around HIV tomorrow if every single person in Ireland who's living with HIV stood up and said, I'm living with HIV. Because most ordinary people think that HIV is not in their lives. They think they don't know anyone living with HIV. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that they do. They bloody well do. And of course, most people don't stand up and say that because they can't. Because they don't feel it's safe or possible for them to do that. And if you are living in Carrick-Sylvean or wherever, Tullamore, mm-hmm. and you're on the local team and you're in the local musical society and you're working in the meat factory or something, yeah, I think I wouldn't in those circumstances be able to be open about it.
Yeah.
So I also strongly feel that in the same way about gay people coming out, that people in my position who can, because I live in this gay bubble and who cares, I can come out. I think it's super important that people like me do come out. Mm. Because then that creates a bit more space for other people to come out, and it's a sort of a knock-on effect. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, obviously, you're not a patient and you're not gay or anything, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I mean, I totally agree. I think it's great. I think people who are in a position that they can be up there and out there, mm-hmm. I think that is fantastic. I think it would be great if everyone was there. I think we have to respect people who can't be.
Yes, absolutely. But
I do think it destigmatizes, and I think, yeah, anything that makes something light is sort of going to reduce that feeling that, oh, this, like the worst sort of thing that somebody could do would get up and say, this is, oh, poor me, this is a disaster. I mean, it will terrify somebody else and also create create an issue when there may not be an issue there as well.
Yeah, you know? Because I'm just so aware of it all the time, because any time I'm like on the radio or the TV or in the papers talking about it, I know that for the next few weeks I will get letters to the bar or emails to my easily accessible public email. And they are from people all around the country who are living with HIV, some for a long time, some for a short time, but some of them for years. And they've never told a single soul.
Yeah, no.
Only them and the doctor knows. They've never told a family member, a friend, somebody at work. And it is this massive, huge thing in their heads. And part of me wants to just, write back to them and say, cop the fuck on. Because, he's taking the medication. He knows that he's fine. But it's because he's never going to talk to anybody about it. Or felt he can, it's become this massive dead weight.
And do you think that, though, is, say, a certain generation, like your generation?
Well, bitch, I'm 15 years younger than you are. I wish that was true. And there's definitely, I think, sure, older farmers and stuff. But I get letters from 20-year-olds.
Really? Oh, that's...
Yes.
Because I, my assumption would be all the young guys, because we've lots of new young people and... they're very open, and we say, oh yeah, look, you're fine, you know what to do, this is your medication, and so on, and people we would assume are much, that they're coming in this new era, they never knew people who were sick.
Yeah.
They didn't grow up with that horrendous time, and they're now just, okay, they're positive, but they're going to be on medication, they're going to live a normal life, they can have sex now with, when they're virally suppressed without condoms, and, and you'd say, well, why would you be...
I'm the same. I don't, I wanted to shout at these people and say, just snap out of it. Yeah. Because, they are aware of the advances and all of that.
Yeah.
But it is still so difficult outside of, certain places. Like we're here in Dublin and St. James's and whatever. But people will write me from Tullamore and it's horrible. They live in Tullamore? No. So that stigma is real. It's not...
Yeah.
It is so real to some people.
Yeah, and you can understand, a lot of people then, do you not think that people would move? They tend to, if I think back even time in college, lots of my friends who are gay would have moved to London because it was sort of difficult to stay in Dublin. And maybe, so again, it's difficult to be not only HIV positive, but to be gay in certain communities still. I think that is always a problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we better get to our Q&A. Yes, but you mentioned there in passing about people sort of thinking, oh, it's about time that they got us. They might as well. Tony Walsh, the very well-known historian, keeper of the gay Irish flame, activist, and he's doing a show in Project, called I Am Tony Walsh.
Okay.
It's wonderful. And so he's not here tonight. He normally would be. I met Tony at an AIDS funeral, and then I met him the second time at an AIDS funeral, and the third time at an AIDS, it was at that period.
Yeah.
And I have other friends like that I met through funerals first. But also, this horrible thing galvanized the gay community in a way, and we did things that we never would have imagined we were capable of before this huge thing was presented to us. Yeah. And Tony, I know he tells it in his show, so I can tell you this story too, and he loves to tell it, is I've been HIV positive for, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years or something, and me and Tony work together very regularly, and he used to work with me every Friday up in the Pod nightclub, and he was always late. And one Friday, he turns up and he's later than usual. And I'm up a ladder at the time, like sticking up. You know, at one stage we decorated the clubs with AZT, like giant. Like we were like really, you know, pushing it. And Tony turns up and he's really late. And I have, you know, well, Tony.
Yeah.
And he very quietly sort of says to me, well, I'm just back from the clinic. Yeah, I got a diagnosis and HIV positive. And he swears, and I mean, I did. I looked down from the ladder and I said, it's about bloody time. So it has been part of my life, a huge part of my life, and my friends' lives, and has changed my life in ways that sometimes I'm not even conscious of.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think of all the people I met and all the people I lost. And in a weird way, the kind of strength that I found in it, in a weird way, and the strength that my community found in it, in a weird way, and it brings up so many emotions.
Yeah.
That
and you probably wouldn't be the person you are now.
Oh, I definitely wouldn't be.
And so, you know, some things that happen to people sort of allowed them to be something even greater than they were.
And I always say that being gay made me a nicer person.
Yeah.
Because if I hadn't been gay, I might have been a prick. well, because the world is made for people like straight Rory. Yeah. And, you know, it is.
Yeah.
It is. A middle class family, you know, book smart, not horrible looking, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, the world is just made for me, you know?
Yeah.
And I think if you're that comfortable, it's one of the, you know, dangers is that you become a dick or whatever. And so I always thank my lucky stars that I turned out gay. I think it made me nicer and more empathetic. And in a weird way, looking back, I think getting HIV did the same. I spent a lot of time with addicts. And, I think it's also, it's changed me in mostly in good ways. And I know that's a weird thing to say about something that's so bad.
Yeah.
But it has changed my life. And sometimes I realize that it's changed me and it's changed me for the better. I'm oddly going to say. Yes. So everybody get it? No. Shall we have some questions? Yes. Oh, straight up.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
And Sue, you're going to get you some microphones. Yes, we have that on the way. And you can take that one there. Yes, please.
You know, I have a question about PrEP. So
okay.
I would like to know your view on PrEP.
Well, I mean, I think PrEP is, from our perspective, I mean, you have one tablet a day, or episodic treatment. You can take it event-based, which you probably all know about, but it can prevent somebody becoming HIV positive. And it is now relatively cheap. It's available free in many countries in Europe. We're hoping that it will be, like the evidence is that it'll probably be free as well in Ireland in 2019. But at the moment, so we would be advocating. Anybody who comes into the STI clinic and saying, oh, look, you're in again, you know, do you ever think about, you should really think about going on PrEP. So yes, we would be pushing PrEP. PrEP now is the it and immediate treatment of HIV has shown drops in statistics of HIV new diagnosis in Paris, San Francisco, London, all the major cities. And Ireland is totally like an area we should be looking to eliminate new diagnosis of HIV because we're like, well able to do that. So I think, it's
and we have higher than ever diagnosis, right, at the moment? Like it's
Yeah, no, the diagnosis is going up. Yeah, certainly in young MSM, yeah. Whereas...
So two questions following on from that. So with the person who wants to get it tomorrow morning, they have to pay for it? So
€65 a month.
Right. Then my next question is, what's the debate about, you know, PrEP? So you deal with one situation, but is it going to lead to an increase in STDs then?
So there is an increase in STDs, but one of the questions is anybody we prescribe PrEP for, we see every 3 months to give them the next prescription and take the opportunity to do an STI screen and obviously pick up more STIs. So, you know, in the old days before HIV, a lot of patients would have come for routine testing. And now perhaps we're back to that era when people are being more sexually active and we're having this testing and picking up more cases. So that is, you could see a downside. We're going to see more STIs, but hopefully that if we treat enough, that we will drop the levels in the community.
Thank you very much.
Ooh. It's okay, there's a doctor in the house.
I better hope this is a good question. my GU clinic basically got taken over by a cardiac clinic in just outside of London.
Yeah.
That was paid for by someone like Elton John. How do you maintain a kind of public profile of this so things like that don't happen? Because we're seeing cuts where actually cuts shouldn't be happening.
Yeah. I mean, the NHS, you know, people hold it up as the greatest healthcare system ever. But it is, you know, it's a business. So for example, the STI clinics were all set out to procurement. So if you were somebody, you know, had a company that was doing free and cheap testing, they could take over the clinics. So that's what's been happening. So there are the great clinics in London, but there are also pockets that have had all exactly what you describe happening. So I'm hoping that, you know, despite everybody wanting an NHS-type system, that we realise how lucky we are in Ireland. We have had no restrictions on what type of drugs we prescribe. You know, I'm not phoned up like my colleagues in London to say, oh, you know, the cheapest drug is A. You must prescribe A for all your patients, whereas my patients can come in and say, you know, I'm getting a side effect like your dizzy spells. Can we change to something else? In some clinics in London, even though that would be a great idea, they can't do that because the other one is cheaper. So I hope that doesn't happen. We will fight it if it does. But I hope I don't have to do that because I think it's a real problem. You can come to Dublin.
quick question about...
Where's Will waving me?
Hi.
Sorry. Oh, <I'm> sorry. Hi. Hi, Will.
Quick question about community and support services for people living with HIV.
Yeah.
I came back in 2004, so you know, relatively newcomer to the scene in Ireland. Back in 2004, I remember, and the first time I went to AMI and Dublin AIDS Alliance before they became HIV Ireland, there was loads of support services around there for people living with HIV. There was Open Heart House. I remember Friends for Friends.
Mm-hmm. Cordon.
And Cordia, and they seem to have in the last few years melted away. And I just wanted to get maybe your thoughts about that. Medically, we are looking after people very, very well in terms of HIV, although some things can be improved in terms of mental health and things like that. But the support services, both your perspectives on the support services for people living on HIV, particularly the newly diagnosed.
Yeah. So you're right. A lot of those organisations have folded. Some of them, core funding was stopped. You're in an era where it's no longer driven by the emotional support that had been there before because patients were dying. So now you have a better population who aren't dying. So you don't have that tangible emotional stick that you can use the government to give you funding. And also there is, you know, that patient, that there is an assessment, what is value for money? Okay. And now I would perceive that within the health service, HIV isn't deemed any different than, say, somebody with cancer or leukemia or any of those, and that all of these organisations will then have to compete across the board as opposed to having targeted funding. But I think all of that will have to come from a community themselves. I don't think we as medics will be able to drive that. You know, we're still in our awful old building. We can't even get out of that. You know, it's really difficult. So I think you have to be wary as well that, you know, if you set... So what your services are going to deliver and for who and where the need is. And I think the need has changed dramatically. So I agree. I think there is a huge need for new diagnosis where there isn't perhaps for other groups. But how you target that and what you do. And also the key thing is now that you have to have an outcome. So it's not just good enough to say, oh, we're going to support people, but what is that going to deliver? You know, are people going to be supported just as well by their friends and ultimately, you know, come to terms with the diagnosis? So I think it's a new era of, you know, putting in the business plan and showing the outcomes. Mm. That's, I think, so different than it was before.
My own tiny 2 cents about that is, you know, if I'm out in a public place or whatever, for you know, in the bar or something, a person will start sidling up to me, and I can tell immediately from the look on their face what it's going to be about. And what it is they've been recently diagnosed, and they don't really have somebody they can talk about it yet. And in the past, I would have said, oh, this place, Corja or Open Heart House, whatever, off you go. And now there's really nowhere to send them. I mean, HIV, I just do a great job, but I was talking about that too. But that's what I... It sounds simple, but what I want is there to be somewhere to send them if it's the first Tuesday of every month or whatever it was. Because people need to talk to other people who are in the same position. And at the moment, there's nowhere to send them. No. And in the old days, you were going to the clinic every week or every day or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. You immediately got to know people.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen anymore. You're only going to the clinic once every 6 months, maybe, or whatever. And that's what I think is missing. Somewhere to just send people along to have a cup of coffee and talk to other people like they're in the same position. That's my pat easy answer. Another question. We have an answer.
Hi, Panty. Hi, Prof. Mulcahy. So I think we can all agree here that Irish society in the past has had a highly negative view on sexuality and sexual health. And I'm of a very strong opinion that, you know, we've seen so many things come so far with the abortion referendum and the gay marriage referendum. Do you think that we should be pushing more for aiming for the government to imply something that, you know, there's standardised things being taught to children, you know, sexuality, consent, sexual health, anatomy, physiology, because I know for a fact that most people that I've met in my own personal life haven't an absolute clue about any of it. So it's quite understandable why people are at risk. And, you know, I'm just wondering what your opinion is. Like, do you think that there is, like, what could we do to change? Do you think that that would be more appropriate to actually educate people? Because, yes, they're consenting to sex, but if they knew the full extent of it, would they still consent to it? Sorry, it's a bit of a rant there.
I mean, I think things have improved, and certainly the new programs in the schools are well thought, they're going forward. I think there's always, like, we send out our nurses all the time, there's never enough of them to be answer the call to do a sexual health talk in schools. Then they're always the most popular. But probably, you know, they get called in a transition year in secondary school, you know, a bit late, really, come on. And most of the kids are all starting to be sexually active, or certainly have been sexually active at that point. So, yeah, but... As to what we can do as a community, say, I think if you had a groups of people who had that educational brief, because it is a specific, you know, not everyone can teach, and not everyone can get up and talk, and not everyone can negotiate with younger people in the right way. And there are some great people, and I think if we had panels of those that were available to teach, I think that's a great thing. I think if there's any opportunities for teaching or educating, I think, you know, we should look at that. But in terms of organisational structures within the educational system, they walk, like, I know some of my friends work in that, and they walk a really narrow line in trying to get certain thing programs over the line with the huge group of parents who totally disagree with it versus the parents who want to agree with it. And it can be very, very difficult. So But I do think there's a huge call from many schools, and I know, say, McQuinlan does a huge amount of education. There are lots of people that do a lot of education, but yeah.
I'm conscious of the time. Let's have two more quick ones, but we really will have to move upstairs. Yes, maybe over here.
No, I'd just like to ask, because obviously with medications so fantastic now, we have PrEP, we mm-hmm. now have your undetectable equals untransmittable.
Yeah.
Do you think, are we nearing the end now? Are we nearly there?
Okay, cure, you mean?
Well, cure, yes.
I don't think cure is in the near future. It'll probably be, you know, we've been saying this for ages, but it's certainly down the road. And that the cure, when it comes, I think it will. But I think it will mean you would take somebody who is positive, who is on just the one pill a day, having a happy life and doing fine, and then going to say, okay, I'm going to blast you to get this to your, for your lymph glands to release this sort of hideaway virus to then treat it. So it's not going to be an easy cure as such.
God damn it.
So that is the big debate. People are saying, you know, we're investing so much money in looking for vaccinations and so on. And is that going to be real? So I'm not sure in terms of how things are going to develop. I think my role will diminish. I think the roles of the hospitals will diminish. I think where the future is in the community. So if I was to ask the community to do anything, I think we need to set up more testing. I think they will take over dispensing PrEP. I think they'll take over PEP. I think it will be program. I'll be happy to drive it. We're not, you know, I think these, you know, you have to, when people want things to be kept in a hospital, that's because they want to keep their own importance or their own jobs and create a mystique around treatment. If patients are well, that does not need to happen. So I think a lot of the European countries, Germany, even Russia, you know, people are now looking at the communities to develop community-based programs. And I think we have good community-based programs at the moment. You know, the Gay Men's Health Project is fantastic. The outreach is fantastic. I think, you know, there's a further level that they can go to. I think it's so exciting for them, and I think it'll be innovative in terms of Irish health. I think it's another area we can develop, definitely.
It sounds like you're going to retire there, Fiona, or something.
That's what I'm saying. I need a new role in life now.
Let's do one last question. I'll let you choose the person because I can't. I'll get into trouble if I. But to say, Fiona, you're going to stay for a glass of wine, aren't you?
Oh,
so
yeah.
If you had some burning thing, you know, she'll be around for a while. Yeah, gonorrhea. She has a script with her. Who really wants to ask the last question? Oh, do we not have one? Oh.
Good.
Okay. Let's finish that up. Yeah. So let's have a glass. Just to remind everybody that this was a fundraiser tonight for HIV Ireland and for GCN Magazine. It's done very well. Thank you very much. They've earned some money. Lisa at some point will tell us all. So thank you all so much for coming. Thanks, Professor Mulcahy.
Thank you.
She saved my life.
Thank you.
And we'll see you upstairs for a glass of wine.
Okay.
This live event was kindly supported by GlaxoSmithKline and co-promoted by HIV Ireland. Thanks so much for listening, and why not check out gcn.ie and our monthly magazine for all things queer and alternative.